Hi, this is Morgan Michael welcoming you to Kindsight 101, the podcast, where you'll hear from world-renowned educational leaders about the mobilizing power of kindness. I believe that we all have an innate need to be seen, heard, and understood. When we dedicate ourselves to kindness, the ripple effects in our schools can be life-changing. Through this podcast, I want to challenge you to question your assumptions, amplify your insight, and embrace a willingness to go beyond the status quo in education. Together, let's learn how to make a big impact, one small act at a time. You're going to love my guest today. Through her vulnerable poetry, she has made meaningful connections to tens of thousands of loyal followers on Instagram. You might be thinking, how does this relate to teaching? Well, we discuss the ways that writing enables us to process our self-discovery and emotions. Excellent teachers recognize the place for meaningful reflection in their practice, not only for themselves, but for their students. We touch on the concept of process over product, overcoming fear, getting to know the quiet, unassuming people in our lives because they often surprise the world with how much they have to say when given half a chance. And we talk about developing a sense of worthiness. This conversation is a warm cup of tea for the teacher's soul. Britton Oakman, who is currently combining dreams and ambitions abroad in Scotland while completing her Master's of Science, Health Psychology, is a soulful Canadian writer and storyteller, health and wellness advocate, and incredibly popular Instagram personality. You can find her at b.oakman, O-A-K-M-A-N, on Instagram. For more information, visit my website, smallactbigimpact.com, and search for episode 21. I want to thank you for the wonderful reviews that you've left for this podcast on iTunes. Your reviews make a big difference in helping other educators find this show. If you think that I'm doing good work here and you'd like others to get inspired and join our 21-day kindness challenge and movement, I'd love it if you would take a minute, head over to iTunes and leave a review. Thank you so much. I want to dig into a little bit about your early writing and what drew you to the writing process. So I personally love writing and I only really invited it willingly into my life recently. It's like I needed permission to be professional or to see myself as a writer, which would never happen out the gate because we're all at that point where we start at zero. But I've realized that being a writer is more of a practice than sort of a career or title. And, you know, that being said, I have this distinct memory of being in grade two and I was super jazzed about the craft of creating, you know, this compelling narrative. And I started a writing club then, like as a 7-year-old. And I look back on that, I know, and I have to laugh. Like maybe I was more in tune with myself then than I was, say, in my early 20s. So I want to talk to you a little bit about your early writing process. And when did you first get started with writing poetry or otherwise? And do you have an early memory of connecting, you know, on a soul level with writing?
Oh man, that's such a great question. I love your story because it's so true. Like as children, we don't feel that pressure to define or label or fully have something to show for what we call ourselves. Like if we call ourselves a writer when we're older, there's this expectation that we're going to produce something. It's going to be good and it's going to be worthy of sort of having that label. And so I think it started really organically for me when I was younger. I really can't even remember a specific year or age, but I started out journaling. That's sort of where it started for me. I just had these little diaries with little locks on them and, you know, they were filled with little musings and boys and just, you know, all those things that kids and young and adolescents are going through.
Yep.
And at some point, and I really can't even tell you when, I think it was probably around 11, 12 is when I really started writing poetry. And I remember it being very convoluted. It was like I was trying to say something and I didn't quite know, I couldn't quite say it. Mm-hmm. And so it always came out quite wordy and quite, as my high school English teacher would say, quite fluffy. I had a lot of fluff in my writer, in my writing. And he was always like, you know, just say what you want to say. Like, if you can say what you want to say with, you know, 10 words, don't use 50 words. And I thought that was really interesting because I think sometimes it's actually harder to say something important with fewer words.
Yes.
Because sometimes it's easier to have that message get a little bit watered down than to actually have this really poignant thing that we want to say and kind of own it, whatever that is that we say. And so that's probably that memory I have of just being a very kind of fluffy, kind of a bit obscure writer.
Interesting.
And yeah. And as I got older, I always felt like my writing was like a part of my soul. Like it was a very vulnerable part of me and something that I didn't really share with anyone. And probably in my late teens, I showed a friend and she was like, you know, this is really good. Like you should share it. And I'm like, ooh, like what would that look like? And, I didn't really know. And that's kind of where the platform of Instagram came into play. Now I didn't start that till probably, I think it was like 2012 or so. But I felt like I really wanted some community around writing. And I didn't really have that in my kind of everyday life. And so I guess in this day and age of this rising social media, I kind of was like, you know what? Like I've been really inspired by people I've been finding on here and the work I'm reading. And maybe there's a place for me there too.
Yes.
And so I started to share under the, with a pseudonym under the handle Photo Poetry. And that was like this beginning for me in sort of more of a intentional writing, wanting to grow as a writer and sort of, yeah, dig into that a little bit more.
Wow. That's so interesting. And I think it's really interesting that you started with a pseudonym, which separates you, as a fragile, you know, vulnerable entity from your work, which I think we all kind of do that in one way or another, whether it's the way that we interact in the world and sort of that first representative that we send forth before our true self can actually connect with who it is that we're trying to interact with. But excuse me. So I want to talk a little bit about that and even this idea of perfectionism and sort of like success in writing. So Brené Brown has discussed at length about this shitty first draft and the one where you kind of spew your thought outs and perhaps even something comes of it or perhaps not. And Glennon Doyle Melton has spoken of this practice of just simply getting her butt in a chair and doing the work and allowing for some of it not to be gold. And, you know, Seth Godin has talked about this idea that writer's block is actually a fallacy and that we all use this excuse kind of to allow us not to create the work that we're meant to be creating, which I think on some level, I think about this idea of your fluffy writing. And I wonder, like you said, was that sort of an out so that you didn't have to actually tune into what your true message was? Because actually standing in the essence of who we are can be super scary. So I'd love to know what's your opinion on sort of writer's block and how do you approach this perfectionist driving when you're writing?
Yeah, that's such a great question and such a really, I think it can be a roadblock for a lot of creatives, whether it's writing or otherwise. And I think I call myself a recovering perfectionist. It's definitely something I've struggled with, something that still can come into play for me in different situations. But I think that a lot of it comes down to fear. And that's the 4-letter F word that's had like a really big impact on my life. Like it's just, it's been something I've dealt with a lot. And I think it comes up in the writing process. And I think that, writer's block, what can often happen, at least in my own experience, is that you've kind of built yourself up to a level where you're expecting something of yourself, like you say, almost this perfection, and everything you kind of are coming up with, it falls short because we are our own toughest critics. Like that cliche will probably always ring true. And we, I think, have this this interpretation of others thinking that they expect of us this level of perfection when in real fact, I think what people crave is authenticity.
Yes.
And seeing that, even someone they maybe admire or someone that, they've found to be, to spread wisdom for them or things like that. Like that, that person also struggles, that that person also has doubts and all those things that are just so fundamentally human, you know, they're just part of our experience. And kind of my solution for writer's block, I usually find, is that I just need to tune in to just real life a bit more, like engage in everyday life. I need to experience, I need to get out, I need to try something new. I want to, I don't know, have a conversation with a stranger. I almost need to just kind of challenge that kind of box we sometimes put around ourselves. And I kind of need to break through. And because I draw a lot of my inspiration for writing just from experience and interactions with others, I just find that to be really fundamental. And I try not to force it. It's kind of this fine balance between challenging myself, but also really listening to what I have to say at the same time.
I love that. And I think that's a really profound point, that not needing to force it and allowing the process to sort of move through you. Elizabeth Gilbert, who, you know, is the author of Big Magic and Eat, Pray, Love, she said that when, you know, this inspiration calls, she answers it, and she realizes that the genius isn't necessarily residing in her directly, but that it sort of passes mm-hmm. through her. And she, mm-hmm. I mean, she's alluded to it, like dancing with inspiration and not asking anything of it and almost like personifying it. So within that process of sort of being open to experiences, do you actually create like a scheduled time for writing, weekly or daily, to make it happen? Or is it more organic? Do you feel called to it? Or what's your process for writing?
That's such a great question. Not something I've thought about a ton, to be honest. You know, a lot of writers will say, write every day, you know, no matter what it is, whether it's, like you said, you're sort of just kind of spewing whatever comes out, whether it's this profound thing, something mm-hmm. you're going to share or not, like just write what you see, what you hear, what you feel. As much as I have tried that, I think that there's seasons of writing for me. Mm-hmm. So currently, writing is an important sort of process for me. But it's also not maybe my priority in this season that I'm in right now, being in Scotland and almost being at the tail end of completing my master's. So
yes,
it's something that I've tried to have in this current season as a thing of play and not of feeling like I have to do it. So I think for me right now, it's been a bit more of an organic process, not feeling like I need to produce content. I need to, you know, post this and this every other day, or, you know, things like that. Yes. It can be really easy to get caught up in those sort of kind of details and those sort of these new challenges we face in the online sphere that would have never really have existed in quite the same way prior to that. And so right now it's something I've just been trying to come to the heart of why I started writing in the first place. And that's because it's something that brings me joy, and it's something that's just very much a part of me. I think that's so important to not lose sight of why we invest in something in the first place.
I love that. I think that's so important, because you're right. We can mm-hmm. kind of lose our why. We can lose that, yes. that compass that directs us back to that authentic reason why we create. And mm-hmm. I think when we tune into that, it takes not only the pressure off, because I think mm-hmm. you're right. I think with the online world, there's a tremendous amount of pressure, like you said, to be relevant, create content, do all these things that really, I mean, you're not going to be creating anything worthy of reading and listening to and viewing yeah. if it's not coming from an authentic place, because people can see right mm-hmm. through that. And I think you're right. And I've heard from a number of people and actually even neuroscientists who say that mm. this element of play is the antidote to perfectionism, which I think is so fascinating. And it's really interesting that you talk about poetry this way in writing, because probably that's, in a way, that anchor that keeps you balanced within the craziness and the amazing demands on your life right now, right? I mean, there's a lot
yes,
going on.
Yes, I agree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So absolutely.
It's an interesting thing. I do want to talk a little bit about how art not only has the ability to bring us joy, but Neil Gaiman, who I know you've referenced a few times in your beautiful, profound Instagram account, which, by the way, I haven't said, but everybody needs to check this account out. It is amazing. But he said, you know, life is sometimes hard. Things can go wrong in life and in love and in business and friendship and health and all the other ways that life can go wrong. And then when things get tough, this is what you should do. Make good art. Make it on the good days. Make it on the bad days too. So how has your art, your beautiful, insightful, vulnerable poetry helped you process life's adversity? Did you seek it out deliberately, or was there sort of that innate urgency that led you to use that sort of as a conduit to work through it?
I think it's been quite innate, to be honest. I've used the word catharsis quite a bit to describe how writing has sort of been a part of my life, and to sort of work through, honestly, usually the really difficult situations. I would say, as much as my writing often has a bit of a silver lining or really positive or encouraging message, a lot of it is born of seasons of incredible struggle, pain, loss. Mm-hmm. Those really tough feelings and experiences to navigate. And I think that something that I've really kind of come to terms with through all those difficult situations is that I sort of have a choice in and after to decide how this experience is going to shape me. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of the difference between letting a really difficult situation make you bitter, resentful, having just this really pessimistic view on the world and all the terrible things that do happen on a daily basis, and then realizing that, you know, we can't control everything that happens, but we do have a choice how we respond and how we choose to let it kind of move us forward, and how we choose to be a part of this world and what that looks like. So yeah, it's really something that it hasn't been easy by any means. Mm-hmm. I went through being someone who always said, like, oh, everything happens for a reason, to having a series of you know, difficult years where this saying just no longer held that truth for me, or what mm-hmm. I thought was truth, and instead, again, it's sort of moved into this, you know, I can't understand why everything happens, but there is goodness, there is growth, there is healing, there's these really positive things that can come from really difficult circumstances.
I agree. And I think it's such a beautiful message, because you're right. It's, we can't control everything. We can't have certainty over our lives, really. There are so many different roadblocks and difficulties and even joyous moments that we don't expect that can sometimes derail everything in our lives. So I think having that fundamental understanding that there will be uncertainty, and that our framing of it is what really matters. And I think I see that a lot in your work, and it's so valuable. And I think there needs to be more of that message. And I think this podcast is truly about that. I think the idea of kindness really needs a rebrand, because it's really about seeing people, and it's really about allowing that uncertainty into our lives and knowing that we are good at heart, and there is good at heart, and to look for that, and to have that power and that ability to see that, I guess, on some level. So absolutely. I do want to dig in a little bit deeper to your sharing of your personal story with the Instagram community, including, and you can speak to this more, but I'll just give a little bit of an introduction. So you have mentioned that you've been diagnosed with a general anxiety disorder. And first, would you be willing to share some of your story with regards to that with our podcast following? And I think I think that we're all fundamentally sort of seeking this vulnerability in one another. And it's that fundamental quality that I think is responsible for connection and belonging. And how has being vulnerable like this in such a public way allowed you to accept and own your story more fully?
I distinctly remember when I first started sort of really having anxiety being a really large part of my life. This is almost, this is about 8 years ago now. I felt very isolated. I felt like people didn't understand. I didn't really understand myself. And it was a very difficult time for me. And I felt even a bit, I don't know if ashamed is the right word, but I did feel a little bit like I didn't know how to explain to people. I owed people an explanation.
Right.
And that's where, well, probably my most, popular piece, you could say, Anxiety Doesn't Knock First. That's where that was born from, was me, having people in my life that sort of demanded an explanation for why I couldn't follow through with, maybe a social event or something like that. And realizing that, that was not going to be a healthy, use of my energy, I guess, at that time in my life, if I was spending it always trying to owe people an explanation, always trying to make other people feel comfortable or satisfy their own, feelings. And that just wasn't something I could do at the time.
Yeah.
It was a very difficult time in every way. It really, as J.K. Rowling has said, and this is paraphrasing, you know, that anxiety and that time in my life became like the rock bottom that I built my foundation on. Like that was a total undoing of everything I knew, and a rebuilding that I am better for, but it has still been incredibly difficult. And yeah, it really rocked every aspect of my life, socially, mentally, physically, spiritually, socially. It became just a very, like I said, a growing time, but a very challenging time, because as humans, we don't like that uncomfortable feeling.
No.
We don't like to be unsafe or out of control or vulnerable.
Yes.
Or yeah, we crave that homeostasis, that state of equilibrium where we know that we're, you know, stable to some degree. And for many years I didn't have that, but I fought, you know, I fought for it. And what's beautiful is that mental health and anxiety and depression, these other things that people encounter, is just becoming so much more of a daily conversation. And I'm so encouraged by that.
Me too.
Yeah, like organizations like To Write Love on Our Arms and a lot of other organizations as well. But there's now a place for people to ask questions, to seek help, to feel like they aren't alone. And I feel like at the time when I first was experiencing anxiety, I didn't necessarily feel like I had a lot of avenues.
Yeah.
And so writing was sort of, again, an outlet for me in that way. And it's something, like I mentioned earlier, that choice of what flows out of it. And I realized that I'd been put in a really unique position to encourage others that were maybe experiencing that same situation or something similar, and that I could relate to them on a level that most people couldn't.
Right.
And all of a sudden I started to see that insight as almost a gift, almost something that gave that time in my life purpose. And I haven't fully, you know, anxiety is still something that I deal with, and it's something I write about often. But from sharing that piece I mentioned, I could not believe the response I got, how many people it resonated with, how many people it gave words to a feeling that they had that they didn't know how to express. And one of my favorite things is just letting people know that they matter, that they're seen, that they, you know, that they're important, that there is purpose on their life, that they, you know, that their life is special and unique. And it, you know, and I think it's such kind of a simple idea in some ways, but it's so profound. And in this world of, like, you know, so much, seemingly so much connection.
Yes.
There's really a lack of genuine connection.
Yes.
And there's still so much loneliness,
yes,
despite this instantaneous sort of connection to the outside world. And that's such a fascinating and a slightly horrifying kind of situation, I think.
It is. It's like this weird juxtaposition, right?
Yes.
You have super connection at your fingertips. Mm-hmm. And yet, like you said, loneliness is literally on the rise. They've done studies about it and it's on the rise. And and it does seem strange, but I think you're right. I think that ability to not only make people feel like they matter and that they're seen and heard, but also to help them to understand that they're not weird, that other people, many other people, feel the way that they do. And that group feeling, that ability to sort of, in a way, create a tribe for people who are identifying with this is incredibly powerful. And I think that's what it's all about. I think it's about people being able to accept and deeply like love essentially who they are, and then to find that same acceptance in the world and not feel like they have to conceal it because they feel unworthy or different. And I personally have identified with so many of your posts, and you have such an eloquent way of, like you said, like expressing the universality of our, you know, human condition with your poetry. And can you think of any people that kind of stand out to you in terms of reaching out and how some of your posts or stories have been able to touch them, or anything that surprised you in a positive way in terms of how people have been affected by your work?
I'm so overwhelmed and just, I feel really blessed by just the outpouring that I get from people. And it still is hard for me to comprehend when people say, you know, like, your words have profoundly, you know, changed my life. Like, I started this blog or business because, you know, you gave me, or I found confidence in the words you say, and, you know, your words have gotten me through a really difficult time, and people going through illness, going through loss, going through just really difficult times. And I think, in a way, helping people, feel a little less alone. And I mean, I'm trying to think of a really specific example, but really, I think that gets at the heart of most of the messages I get from people. And I think you mentioned Brené Brown earlier, and she is one of my mentors. She doesn't know it, but she is. And I'm reading Braving the Wilderness right now, her newest book.
Isn't it great?
It is so good. I just want to talk about it all the time. And there's a quote she says quite early on about true belonging not requiring us to change who we are, but requiring us to be who we are.
Yes.
And I think that is something that I've kind of learned almost the hard way, but gotten to a point where, you know, trying to speak from that place, it kind of has helped other people be confident in being who they are.
Yes.
And it's beautiful to see that transcends the platform of Instagram being this, you know, this online social media platform that, you know, I'm virtually strangers, but it's at the same time, there's a community of people that have found real value in being there. And I'm just so happy to be a part of it. It's been really cool.
Yes. And I think what's amazing is that your words are able to cut through the sort of the superficial nature that Instagram often brings out in people, which is quite remarkable. So I think I think you're right. I think that's what it's allowed people to do, is connect deeply and to own their stories and to accept themselves and say, here we are. I do want to talk a little bit about, and I don't know if you've had any sort of negative reactions, but I have a friend who's actually a radio DJ for The Peak in Vancouver, and her name's Casey Jo Luz, and she blogs regularly about her experience, you know, with life and depression and anxiety. And in her freestyle writing, it's just such an evocative and powerful message, again, around worthiness, but also she's quite raw with the struggle and the feeling of judgment and this sort of dichotomy between who she is on the radio and who she is really deep inside. And I know that she's changed people's lives through her work as a blogger in the similar way to how you have, because she's really been willing to share her experience and normalize this experience of anxiety and depression and even her experience with suicide attempts and things like that. Really profound experiences that are very, very raw. And she has that gift as well of reminding people that they're not alone in their suffering and that they are worthy of that love and belonging. But on the flip side, she has received so much hate mail. There have been armchair critics who disparage that rawness, that vulnerability, accuse her of attention seeking, among, you know, other things. And, you know, I think about this idea that we kind of magnify the flaws in others that we sort of see in ourselves when we're judging people and where that judgment truly stems from. But it must be so difficult to be standing in the essence of who you are in a very public way and ultimately always have people coming at you in one way or another, sort of trying to cut you down because it makes them feel uncomfortable. Have you had that kind of experience, or have you dealt with any of that type of judgment?
Well, let me preface this by saying I'm a very sensitive individual. I would classify myself as part of the, I think it's around 20% or so that is a highly sensitive person. So yes. I typically take things quite personal, which has made it challenging for me when I share about things that feel a bit, things that are maybe a bit taboo or a bit, you know, kind of at odds with certain people. However, I've actually had very little backlash.
Wow.
I've maybe had the odd person who's just kind of had a rude comment, but I really have not experienced a lot of negativity or a lot of that sort of situation where someone, you can almost, like you said, kind of, it feels like someone is not comfortable with the level of sort of rawness that you're sharing. And I do know people that have.
Yes.
But I do think long and hard about the way that I approach something and discuss it. And I don't know, you know, if that has anything to do with it. Mm. But when I share, you know, a piece on Instagram, my caption will usually bring a lot more depth to what is sort of what I'm getting at or my personal experience. And to me, when you're speaking from a place of personal experience and just your own feelings, no one has the right to take that away from you or minimize that, how that was, because that's yours, you know, like that's something that you're sharing. You're not telling other people what to do. You're not telling people how they should think or feel or act. You are speaking from your own experience, potentially to you know, inspire or help others. But I think that I have quite like not, I don't have much tolerance if people aren't willing to sort of at least approach something with that respect of just sharing very authentically, right? Like I think that does say more about someone than it does about the person they're sort of attacking. So I've been quite fortunate.
Well, and that's so good. I'm so, you know, happy that that's been your experience because I know it can be tricky being in that public forum, and then absolutely, having the armchair critics tune in and say their bit. So, but I think you're right. I think ultimately it comes down to who it is that we allow to criticize or to even have judgment about our journey and our experience. And I think the people who stand beside us, who truly know us, may have earned that ability to do that. But really, the people we don't know, the strangers who don't connect with the essence of who we are entirely, just have not earned the right to do that. So I think it's a really important message, I think, for people who do, like you say, struggle with perfectionism or consider themselves to be recovering perfectionists, because I think often what that type of striving leads us to do is to be pleasers or to to really put a lot of weight on how people respond to the way that we interact with them. And I think if we're operating from a respectful, genuine, authentic place, and that's met mm-hmm. with whatever kind of judgment or negativity, that's really more about them than it is about us or the way that we are communicating. And I know many people who get so concerned about people liking them or disappointing people. And I think mm-hmm. the power of not allowing basically unworthy critics to weigh in is really important.
Yeah, I think it can be really tough though.
Yes.
Especially if we are already struggling with maybe our own identity or our own self-worth. Mm-hmm. Or a bit more we can be a bit more influenced by that. And that can be a really tough situation if that's something that you're working on as an individual. And as I think I'm a Enneagram 4, which is the helper. So that idea of people pleasing is mm-hmm. definitely something that I've struggled with over the years. And just I talk a lot about boundaries and, mm-hmm. and self-care. And I think that these things are just so important that we're not only in like a really like practical sense of like, oh, well, I'm going to set time aside for this, but also being careful. Like you said, how close we let people that don't quite haven't kind of earned that right to really speak into our lives or criticize something or sort of speak those hard truths, how close we let those people and be really mindful of who we surround ourselves with. I think that's just really important that we have people that build us up, that encourage us, that leave space for us to be who we are, regardless of what that looks like and whether it's comfortable or not. And it's not easy. And it's obviously a two-way street because we're also that person potentially for someone else. But I think that that's a really fundamental part of connecting with others.
Yes. So I want to talk a little bit about this creating space for yourself, whether it is through mm-hmm. sort of a reflective practice like meditation, or even just the practice of creating healthy boundaries around vulnerability and disclosure and what you're willing to share. So, you know, you've said that you can go kind of from excited to discouraged in a heartbeat when you're really focusing on that desire to achieve something instead mm-hmm. of putting energy into the steps necessary to make it happen. And this piece about, you know, juggling so many hats. I know that you mm-hmm. you're a consistent Instagram blogger. You've got t-shirt lines. You've got, you know, you're doing your master's degree. You've got a book in the works. You're a traveler. You're a wife. There is so much. I'm sure there's much more that I'm, you know, not even mentioning. And I go in the pursuit of that success. It can be really easy to find yourself hanging on for dear life on this, you know, warp speed freight train. How do you find that balance? Is balance even relevant or achievable? How is it that you get that self-care and that and work in this reflective space so that you can still be a wholehearted person?
That's such a good way to put it, a wholehearted person. Well, as far as balance goes, that is like a can of worms I'm not even going to go on to too much, but I did write a piece about it a couple weeks ago, so if anyone's curious. Yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with self-reflection, self-awareness, kind of checking in with ourselves. And that sounds kind of odd because you're like, oh, well, you know, I'm with myself all the time. But there's something about being intentional in kind of seeing where we're at with what we need as a human. And I think that sometimes well, there used to be sort of this push towards hustling and being busy and producing things and accomplishing things. And I think that people just realize that that's really tiring. It's almost this state of being that isn't sustainable. Mm-hmm. We're not meant to always be in a constant state of accomplishing and doing. Mm-hmm. I used the Calm app, and it recently highlighted the importance of non-doing, which is essentially just a state of being. And seeing what that looks like. And I think we're actually not very good at that in this day and age.
I agree.
I'm really bad for that. I'm a serial multitasker. I'll be like watching something on my phone, eating, and like something else is going on. And I'm like, what am I doing? Like,
I know.
And that kind of goes back to what you said about wholeheartedness. Like, when you are almost overdoing it, you aren't able to really give your best self to any one thing, because it's almost like you're kind of splitting yourself in too many directions. And
yes,
I'm one who can get kind of overwhelmed and towards a stage of burnout quite easily.
Yeah.
And especially just with my anxiety, I have to listen to what it's telling me when I'm feeling anxious. That's something that I've had to learn to do. And also being an introvert, which everyone thinks is hilarious that I'm an introvert, because I'm an introvert with extroverted tendencies.
Yes.
So I'm quite sociable. I can rise to the occasion. But at the heart of it, I need that time to kind of refuel, recoup. And I think whether you're introverted or extroverted, self-care is essential. Just may look a little different for people. So for me, it's really stripping it down to sometimes just time alone. Mm. It's getting enough sleep. It's eating well. And there's been a lot of posts about this recently, about it's not just bubble baths. It's not just, you know, things that are shareable on Instagram or whatever platform you choose to share on. It's just really about, where am I? How am I doing? What do I need right now? Like, what changes do I need to make so that I don't keep coming into this place of feeling sort of maybe overwhelmed or anxious or burnt out or uninspired? I mean, that's usually for a lot of people, those first couple stages is just not feeling very motivated. Mm-hmm. And when you're not motivated about something you love, I think that's really a time to reevaluate how much you're doing, what you're doing, you know, how much of yourself you're giving to things that maybe is out of proportion to how much they deserve. And I think sometimes that does come down to just prioritizing and taking a step back and, you know, seeing what that looks like in both kind of an everyday sense and a long-term goals situation as well.
Absolutely. And I think you're so right. I think you're bang on about this neat and tidy way of capturing self-care in the social media world. And, you know, this is what I've done. But it's like, if you've got your phone out while you're doing that, are you really practicing self-care? You know, are you feeling it wholeheartedly? Is it replenishing you? It's an interesting thing to talk about, because I think you're right. We can be going through the motions of it without actually feeling the nourishment of what it's meant to accomplish. So I think it's a very, very important point. And just this practice of sitting alone and asking ourselves those seemingly kind of challenging questions about what's important to me, what do I need, where am I going, and is what I'm doing actually reflecting what I believe is important. And
so that alignment between.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And sometimes it can be very difficult to come to terms and reckon with where you're at in your life and really do that in a conscious and intentional way. But I think you're right. I think it's that centering piece that gets us more in tune with who we are. I want to talk a little bit about your experience because I'm coming from an educator standpoint as a teacher and, you know, an educational leader that really, it's hard to know, and I'm making a huge assumption here, but mm-hmm. I'm wondering what kind of a student you were. And I know sometimes it can be so difficult to know and truly see all of our students, especially the ones who seem to fly below the radar, and not really attract a lot of attention to themselves and maybe achieve well enough, but that we're not really on the, you know, the difficult spectrum or the super genius spectrum. And, and really, I think we all need to know that we matter. All of our students need to know that message. That's what this podcast is about. And I'd love to hear a little bit about your school experience. Did you like school? Did you experience any anxiety in school? Ooh. And what would you want your teachers to have known about you that perhaps they didn't?
Those are great questions. I feel like each of my levels of schooling have kind of had their own unique experience. So in high school, I was not a great student. If you would have looked at my report card, I would have had a couple, you know, pretty good marks in like English. No surprise. Mm-hmm. That was kind of an area I've always enjoyed. But I was kind of a bit more of a social butterfly. I played sports. I always kind of classified myself as just, I'm just not very good at tests and academic aspects of school, which is obviously quite a big part. And it is, you know, I think there's been quite a bit of debate about this in North America about does that learning situation work for all students and all this wide, diverse pool of individuals that you have growing up, and does that one kind of method work for everyone? But regardless, in high school, I wasn't the greatest student. And when I got to, when I did my degree in psychology, I kind of carried that with me because I had kind of defined myself as not really a very good student, but obviously it was important to me and I was, you know, doing my best. And in second year, I was encouraged by, it was a cognitive psychology professor who encouraged me to try studying kind of outside the box. Whereas a lot of people say, you know, notes or this or that, or listen to recordings. And she encouraged me to do mind maps. Huh. And so for me, I got to kind of bring almost a creative aspect into studying. And that's actually been a turning point for me. Among other sort of techniques I've brought into being a student. But that was a turning point. I honestly almost automatically started getting better grades, and that kind of gave me a bit of a boost of confidence in what I was capable of. I realized that I didn't need to, that idea of classifying myself as kind of an average student was limiting myself from what I was actually capable of as a student. And it did take an intervention or sort of that outside input from a professor. And I think that teachers and educators have a really large role to play in that. I think that as students, we look to them as being a source of authority, a source of information, of experience, of someone who has kind of gone before us, right? And coming into my master's, I kind of came in with a confidence of like, I can do well here, you know, and doing my master's in health psychology, something I'm really passionate about, obviously was helpful. When you're learning about things you love, it's a little bit less of a chore and a little bit more of something you enjoy a bit more, obviously not at all times of the year. exams are always exams.
Sure,
and,
they are.
And such, but, I think that there's kind of, there's responsibility on both parts. And I've been really lucky to have a lot of people that have always really encouraged and supported me and really always believed in me. And I think that I've been very fortunate with that. And so I think that is really important, whether it's an educator or a advisor or a counselor or a teaching aide or a mentor. I was a peer mentor in university. I think that it is important that as a student that you can connect with someone that does kind of, that they believe in you. Like you said, that they see you, that they believe in your ability, even if you don't quite believe in it yet.
Yes.
And so I do think that educators do bear a certain responsibility of that, and that they can really make a difference in the lives of their students.
Absolutely. And I think it's so interesting that it took really shaking up the status quo for you, this idea that, you know, we learn with flashcards and through memorization and, you know, by listening to something a million times, that's the only way to do it. And this roadmap that was very different, which really called on you to bring your creativity into it, is what was the answer for you. I think that's so important. And I think as teachers and educators, we have to be creative with our approach with students. If something's not working, it's not that the student isn't capable of learning. It's just we need to find a different way of approaching it. And I know right now there's a lot of research around this practice called sketchnoting, which is essentially taking notes by sketching little drawings and then just placing a few words beside the drawing, but the process of, it's really neat. And so the process of actually sketching and drawing, which you teach the students really explicitly, has this ability to really ingrain it in their brains visually. And I've had this experience when I've studied. It's not that I have a photographic memory per se, but it's more I can remember a piece of information based on the picture that was on that page, right? It's like that brings it out for me. And so I think we all have different ways of creating our stories and the context for our learning. And it's really up to educators to be able to see their students like that and to be able to tap into what is it that really helps you to create the story that allows you to remember some of the important information and to make connections. Because I think it's, you know, education really should be less about the content and the memorization, and especially in this day and age where we have so much content at our fingertips, and really about that critical thinking piece, the analysis, the ability to take a number of different ideas and consolidate them and then create your own ideas around them, and even make art, however that looks. You know, I think we all have different ways of expressing our learning. And I look at the way that you create poetry, and I think that is a reflection of how you've processed the world around you. And I think we need to be able to see children in that light, with that frame of reference, and to be able to empower them to tap into that sooner than what most of us wind up doing, which is going through, jumping the hoops, and then finally when we have this space, we're able to really delve into what was always close to our heart. Like you said, you were 11 years old when you really connected with writing, I think, right? Yeah. And so being able to do that earlier would be a benefit, right?
I think that's huge. Like in doing some research last semester on adherence, it's quite funny that just giving someone information typically isn't enough to evoke change. Isn't enough. It isn't necessarily enough for that person to remember it, for it to actually make a difference. So as an educator, if you do think that all your role is to read through a textbook or, you know, have an hour-long monologue of information, you know, research has shown that's not necessarily the best way for people to learn. So I think you do start to see the classrooms are evolving to some degree to be more interactive, to be more having children use critical thinking to, whether you're a child or an adult, at all stages, being able to be engaged and interact with the material that you're being given, I think is huge. Because if you can apply meaning to it, it's typically going to stick so much better than if you're just given material that really holds, from your perspective, very little value. So I think that idea of kind of working with the fundamental information, but finding a new way to engage with it is would be life-changing for a lot of students and educators. Because I'm sure as an educator, my stepdad's a teacher, when you see your students getting it, when you see them learning, when you see their marks going up, whatever way that they're seeing that shift, I'm sure that that's an incredibly kind of special moment. And, you know, teachers don't become teachers to make the big bucks. You know, they're there to make a difference, right? So I think that it can be a really full circle when you see that your students are connecting and getting that material.
I agree. And you know what's interesting is I see you as a teacher in that respect, because I think the way that you're able to tap into people and connect with them and again send them this message that they matter is essentially at the heart of why most of us became teachers, is to connect with children and really little people, to give them that message that they're important, that they matter, and that they're worthy, right? So I want to be respectful of your time, and I would like to move into the rapid fire of the interview. But before I do, is there anything that you'd like to share or touch on that you haven't really had a chance to do so?
Oh, I think that I would really, again, just want to hit home for people to just really find what it means to be uniquely yourself. Find what that means when you get up in the morning. What does that look like for your day? You know, and I think that there's no one more special that you can be than yourself. There's no one more important than being yourself. And I think that it takes time to really sometimes love ourselves as that authentic being. But I think that that fulfillment, that's where it comes from. And I hope that whatever avenue encourages people, whether it is writing or other people and whatever facilitates that, that I think that intentional everyday practice of loving yourselves and belonging to your authentic self is something that is really going to go the distance in this life.
I agree. I think that's very well said. So, could you define what kindness means to you?
Oh my. Okay. how do I define kindness without using the word kind? I think that it is showing others, it's accepting others and serving others beyond sort of your own agenda or your own needs. I think it's, yeah, meeting people where they're at, which is one of my favorite phrases.
Yes.
And supporting others.
What book or books have you gifted most often to people?
Oh my gosh, am I going to forget it right now? That's embarrassing. Well, I'll tell you one that I just started reading that I think I will be gifting to people. It's a book by Hannah Brechner called Come Matter Here. It's her new book. And it's about an invitation to be here in a getting there world. And I am only a short way into it, but I've already thought of about 5 people that I want to give it to. So I think that'll be one.
Wow. I want to read that book, actually. That sounds that sounds perfect. What one skill or superpower does a teacher need to lead with in order to be effective?
To be honest, I think that integrity is a really big one. I think that, I don't even know how to really to expand on it, but I just think that from integrity flows a lot of really good things, and it creates a safe space for other people.
I agree. Now, sometimes people have answered with the same response, but sometimes this has been different. So I'm interested to know what it is for you. So what one skill or superpower does a principal need to lead with in order to be effective?
Okay. Interesting. I'm never good at picking just one of anything.
That's okay.
So I'm probably gonna get around that by saying one of the most important things, sure. I think, is being a good leader. And obviously that's a very multifaceted answer, but I think leadership as a principal who almost is a representative and someone who is seen and sort of governs both teachers, faculty, and children, parents, I think that leadership's a really important skill, and part of that is listening as well.
Yeah. What one message or quote would you print on one of those quote cups that are sold in big bookstores that would be read by millions? I know.
Well, not to sort of like toot my own horn here, but
please do. Please do. You've earned the right. You've earned the right.
It's really simple. And I just got it put in a necklace, and some people might have seen the piece I shared around my birthday on it. But lean in has become a really profound phrase for me. Leaning in to new experiences, to leaning into myself, leaning into a process, whether it's healing or growth or pain or whatever it is, and not hiding, not repressing, but experiencing something so fully that it can either be, that it sort of fulfills a purpose of whatever it is. So just that simple, lean in.
A really important message that you lean in without judgment on yourself as well, and just do it with the experience in mind. And I think that that's a really helpful message for people who struggle with anxiety and depression, because sometimes we tend to want to cast judgment on ourselves within that process of experiencing something new. And so being able to do it wholeheartedly is so important. I think that we are at a really good place to end our conversation. And I so appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule, Britton, for this important conversation. We have touched on so many, so many topics, but I think your words and your wisdom and your insight are very, very helpful. And I think important for people to hear.
Thank you. It's really been a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you.
This has been another episode of Kindsight 101, the podcast. For links to resources mentioned in this episode, visit smallactbigimpact.com and click on our podcast and choose this episode number. Now, I'd love to give my audience a heads up about my new book, which will provide ideas, actionable strategies, and inquiry-based approaches to creating kinder classroom through serving the community. Subscribe to my blog for more information. Now, I would love to hear from you. What's the biggest insight that you gain from this conversation? Head over to our website, smallactbigimpact.com, leave a comment on our podcast page, or tag and connect with us on social media with the hashtag smallactbigimpact to share your inspiring story of kindness. Can't wait to hear from you.